Welcome to Earth Matters on Gila Membris Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. At the end of this year, the state of New Mexico must notify the Secretary of the Interior if it will move forward with a Gila River diversion under the Arizona Water Settlements Act. The commission must decide if it will pursue a diversion project or instead use AWSA funding to implement non-diversion conservation, efficiency, and sustainable water management alternatives to meet water needs here in southwestern New Mexico. The New Mexico Interstate Stream Commission is in the middle of its decision process, which began in August and will culminate in its decision in November. On October 6, the state legislature's Interim Water and Natural Resources Committee met at Highlands University in Las Vegas, New Mexico. One of the items on the agenda was the Arizona Water Settlements Act. And today, we will bring you the presentations from that discussion. We've got Interstate Stream Commission Deputy Director Craig Repke, former Interstate Stream Commission Director Norm Gaum, UNM Professor Mark Stone, and retired New Mexico Department of Game and Fish biologist Dr. Dave Probst. Let's listen now to ISC Deputy Director Craig Repke deliver the statutorily mandated New Mexico Unit Fund annual report.
For introductions, first, Mr. Chairman, I'm Craig Repke of the New Mexico Interstate Stream Commission.
Good morning, Mark Stone, with the Department of Civil Engineering at the University of New Mexico.
What is your position with the Interstate Stream Commission?
Mr. Chairman, I'm deputy. I wear a couple hats: deputy director and also chief of the Special Water Projects Bureau.
All right.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Norman Gaum. I'm a mostly retired consulting engineer.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Probst. I'm retired from the Department of Game and Fish, and I'm now with the University of New Mexico Biology Department.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to present the Interstate Streams Commission statutorily required report on the Arizona Water Settlement Act. This report presents the ongoing and anticipated planning efforts and associated work that will take place under the Arizona Water Settlements Act through 2014. The Arizona Water Settlements Act was signed into federal law in December of 2004. The act allows New Mexico to divert up to an additional 14,000 acre feet of water from the Gila Basin and provides up to $128 million in funding. New Mexico must inform the U.S. Secretary of the Interior by December of this year if New Mexico will build a New Mexico unit of the Central Arizona Project. If New Mexico does not choose to develop any of the additional water, the water will continue to flow to Arizona and up to $62 million of federal funding will be forfeited. In September of 2004, before the act was signed into law, the Interstate Stream Commission formally adopted a policy to guide it in its consideration of uses of the water and funding provided to New Mexico in the act. The three main tenets of the policy are to recognize the unique and valuable ecology of the Gila Basin, to mitigate any impacts on that ecology, to use the best available science, and to provide for current and future water uses. The tenets of the Gila policy have guided the planning process. To date, there have been over 200 public meetings on the Arizona Water Settlement Act conducted in various venues throughout the region. In the spring of 2011, after almost 10 years of trying to come to consensus, the Interstate Stream Commission began its own two-tiered evaluation process of 41 project proposals, all submitted by stakeholders in the region. The Commission established an evaluation panel that reviewed and ranked the proposals. The evaluation panel was composed of one representative each from the New Mexico Environment Department, the Office of the State Engineer, the Department of Game and Fish, the Interstate Stream Commission, and the Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources Department. The Interstate Stream Commission approved 16 projects for further assessment, integration, and/or refinement. One project, the City of Bayard's, withdrew. Each of the 15 remaining stakeholder proposals has been undergoing comprehensive assessments of technical feasibility, economic costs and benefits, cultural impacts, water supply, and environmental impacts. In response to stakeholder requests, many additional studies are underway or already completed. Over 50 different studies have been entered into. The Interstate Stream Commission staff is also considering studies performed by others, some of whom you will hear today. Ongoing work will be completed in this month of this year. As we speak to you today, a value engineering workshop is beginning. The value engineering workshop will provide important information to the Interstate Stream Commission prior to their decision. A more complete description of the workshop can be found in Appendix 2, Value Engineering Workshop and Engineering Design Flowchart, beginning on page 22 of this report. Budgeting from the New Mexico Unit Fund. The New Mexico Unit Fund has received $9.04 million in January for each of the calendar years 2012, 2013, and 2014. An identical amount will be deposited in January 2015. For fiscal year 12 through 15, the Interstate Stream Commission has budgeted a cumulative total of $7,460,000 to support contractual services for engineering, hydrologic, geologic, ecologic, and economic assessments. For the current fiscal year 15, the work budgeted totals $3,310,000. Ecologic studies and assessments account for more than $1.06 million of that total. As of October 3rd, 2014, the cash balance in the New Mexico Unit Fund is $23,934,967.45. The Interstate Stream Commission has throughout the years continued its process of public involvement, including facilitated quarterly public meetings. The Commission has also created a website dedicated to the New Mexico portion of the Arizona Water Settlement Act. Scopes of work, reports, and ongoing efforts are posted there. The public and stakeholders may also post comments on the website. There have been some issues raised about climate change. The Interstate Stream Commission contracted with Dr. David Gutzler, climatologist at the University of New Mexico, for a study of potential effects of climate change on Gila River flows. His study is posted on the New Mexico AWSA website, and he used both dynamic models and a statistical empirical model to estimate the reductions in stream flow in the upper Gila River due to projected climate change. His studies indicated an approximate 8% reduction in native stream flow. The Nature Conservancy has also commissioned a climate change model by researchers at the University of Arizona. That study estimated a 6% reduction in average flow and a 15% reduction in median flows. The Bureau of Reclamation's own study estimated a reduction of approximately 9%. Incorporating the Nature Conservancy parameters into the ISC diversion model resulted in an approximate reduction of only 3% in average annual diversions under the AWSA. Results under all three projections indicate that flow reductions appear to pose no real problem in the harvesting of additional water allocated to New Mexico in the Arizona Water Settlements Act. I would like to bring to the Commission's attention one other rather unique feature of the Arizona Water Settlements Act. Unlike most large water projects in New Mexico and throughout the West, a New Mexico unit of the Central Arizona Project will be designed, constructed, operated, and maintained and owned by the state of New Mexico. Mr. Chairman, thank you. That concludes my report.
We'll be right back after this short break and continue listening to the New Mexico State Legislature's Interim Water and Natural Resources Committee October 6th meeting on the Arizona Water Settlements Act. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, your host for today's program. Let's continue listening to the New Mexico State Legislature's Interim Water and Natural Resources Committee meeting on the Arizona Water Settlements Act. It was held on October 6th in Las Vegas, and the next speaker is former Interstate Stream Commission Director Norm Gaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have my written testimony before you and also a one-page outline of the findings that I have made in my investigations of the Interstate Stream Commission's planning of a Gila River diversion, which I've conducted over the last year. The findings are helpful guidance, and I hope it will allow me to concentrate my remarks into things that should be of interest to you. My remarks are very critical. My qualifications for making this critique are unique. I have summarized them on the second page of my written testimony, and I would urge that you review them, please. When I was director of the Interstate Stream Commission, about the year 2000, Senator Domenici's office called and said there was a political opportunity to gain something from New Mexico associated with Senator Kyle's need to pass the Arizona Water Settlement Act. The Interstate Stream Commission staff was asked what was needed or wanted. My reply was money. And in fact, Senator Domenici appropriated $100 million, two-thirds of which could be used for any project that meets a water supply demand in the four counties in southwest New Mexico. The other one-third can only be expended on construction of the unit fund. I remember talking to Senator Domenici and his offices in Washington about the concerns that I had and that he shared with regard to the viability of attempting once again to make a Gila River diversion viable. The end result was that two-thirds of the money was appropriated so that something good could come from New Mexico as a result of all this planning effort. I left the Interstate Stream Commission at the end of 2002 when Governor Richardson appointed Esteban Lopez as my successor. I have avoided going to any meetings of the Interstate Stream Commission or any of the meetings of the legislature since I left state employment. But enough people expressed concern to me in late 2013 that I decided to attend the December 2nd, 2013 meeting of the Interstate Stream Commission. I listened to Mr. Repke present to the commission, listened to the commission's brief discussion. After the meeting, I caught Mr. Repke in the hall and I asked him if he had been able to solve the puzzle that makes a Gila River diversion infeasible, in my professional opinion. He didn't answer my question, but asked me to meet with him, which I did a few days later. I spent an afternoon with Mr. Repke and his three staff members in my old office in the corner of the Baton Building, and Mr. Repke and his staff showed me over 100 PowerPoint slides. When we got to the segment of the slides that showed the water that could be diverted from the Gila River, my suspicions were aroused even more, and I asked Mr. Repke for a copy of his spreadsheet that is used to calculate the water available for diversion. He declined. I later filed an Inspection of Public Records Act request for that spreadsheet, and I was denied You may have seen the article in the Albuquerque Journal this past Monday by science reporter John Fleck discussing my request for the model, or you may have seen the editorial in the Albuquerque Journal on Friday that was very supportive of my position. So that is a background story for my remarks and findings to you today. I met with Mr. Repke again in June, and we talked, and I urged him to prepare, as I had strongly recommended in testimony that I presented to the Interstate Stream Commission on April 30th, that he modeled the net yield, the usable water that would result from a Gila River diversion project. I said that it would be easy, and it is my professional opinion that while it may not be easy, it's a straightforward thing to do. Mr. Repke challenged me to prepare such a model, and I have done that. And I'm going to present the results of that to you today. So I'd like to go now to the one-page handout with my findings. First of all, the Interstate Stream Commission and the state engineer have routinely described the amount of water that is legally available for diversion, and it's loosely described as water available for diversion or new water for New Mexico in terms of a 14,000 acre feet per year average. Well, those terms are quite misleading. In fact, they're not true. The reason they're not true is that the long-term average of the water available for diversion, as shown by the Interstate Stream Commission's secret spreadsheet, is only a little above 12,000 acre feet per year. In my corrected version of the spreadsheet, it comes out to about 12,500 acre feet per year. But the average means almost nothing. The median, this is the value that half of the values are lower and half of the values are higher. The median is only 3,700 acre feet per year. By the time, let me back up for a minute. New Mexico's water right, or New Mexico's right, I should say, to divert water from the Gila River is highly conditioned. New Mexico has the most junior right on the Gila River. New Mexico can't divert it all until it pays Arizonans, actually pays the Sector of the Interior, to deliver Central Arizona Project water to the Gila River users who have the senior rights for the water. So New Mexico has a right to develop Gila River water by exchange, but can only divert if it pays in advance for that water. Because the water only comes rarely, 9% of the days in the historical period of record is there water that legally available for diversion, and because water must be diverted at large rates, the diversion facilities and conveyance canals have to be very large to get water out of the river at a high rate and into storage. Because water is available for diversion so infrequently, and in 45% of the years not at all, it is crucial to have storage reservoirs that will store the water for future use. Future use being in the 80% of the time, 90% of the time when water is not available for diversion, and in the years when there is none. The problem with the Gila River alternatives that are left in New Mexico is there are no good reservoir sites remaining. I knew that in 2000 when I was ISC director. I know that even more now because of my study of the reports that the Interstate Stream Commission has prepared. The most recent report prepared for the Interstate Stream Commission by Bohannon Houston, the consulting engineer who has done a lot of work for the commission, indicates that the reservoir sites are so leaky that the reservoirs will have to be lined with thin black plastic liners. Fragile liners will not last for the lifetime of these reservoirs. This is an infeasible and impractical concept that has been put forward at literally the 11th and a half hour in this project, when finally the Interstate Stream Commission has admitted that the sites for its reservoirs are basically worthless as places to store water for future use. So back to my metrics. The median of annual water supply legally available for diversion is only 3,700 acre feet per year. There will be no or very low amounts of water that will come out of those reservoirs that can be delivered for human use, low or no. On the other hand, the costs have gone through the ceiling. The Bureau of Reclamation presented a comprehensive set of costs. They didn't add them all up in one place, so you won't find the number $1.1 billion anywhere in the report, but I added up their numbers, and that's what it amounts to. Further, I made some assumptions and used a financing methodology prepared by GK Baum, investment bankers who have made proposals to the local proponents group that aspires to be the entity that owns and operates this diversion. So I've applied this investment banker's methodology using the Bureau of Reclamation costs. I assumed that you, the state legislature, would fund the project to the tune of $250 million, that all of the federal financing would go toward construction. The remainder would be $445 million that would have to be funded somehow. I assumed revenue bonds, as did GK Baum. When you take the Bureau of Reclamation's debt service, GK Baum's debt service numbers with the operations and maintenance and exchange costs, these annual payments for the water that New Mexico must make, they total $47 million paid every year after the state and federal appropriations. If you assume the project would provide 6,000 acre feet of water per year, which I think is totally impossible, but I did this for the purposes of developing unit costs, which I strongly recommend the Interstate Stream Commission prepare and when I testified before them in April of this year. When I calculated those unit costs and compared them to Deming water rates, I found that the existing Deming water rate for 6,000 gallons a month, that's typical, is a little less than $14 a month. If you were to add Deming's share of the debt service on a unit cost basis, the Deming water rates would increase from $14 a month to $158. If you take the unit cost of water on an acre foot basis, it's almost $8,000 per acre foot of water. I recently read the Bureau of Reclamation Central Arizona Project webpage, and it says that farmers in Arizona cannot afford to pay the Central Arizona Project charge of $30 an acre foot for water, much less $8,000. The other metric that I think is extremely important are the number of listed species in the project area that would be affected both by construction and by the dewatering caused by operations, which others will point to. The Interstate Stream Commission has diminished the impacts, and they've ignored the future compliance costs. I would urge that you ask them how much money the Interstate Stream Commission has spent in the last 5 years or 10 years on Endangered Species Act issues, on the Middle Rio Grande, on the San Juan River, and on the Pecos River. The expenses are huge, and these have not been factored in. The journal editorial that appeared on October 3rd ended with the conclusion, quote, "Its conduct calls its own conclusions into question," end quote. They were referring to the Interstate Stream Commission. In addition to giving you the metrics, summarizing the metrics that I just did, I also want to tell you that I believe the Interstate Stream Commission's planning process has been mendacious, wasteful, and unlawful. I'd be happy to give you specific instances of any of those. I feel that I don't have enough time to really get into the details, but they are in my written testimony. You should know that I have filed a notice of violation of the Open Meetings Act. I hand-delivered that to the Interstate Stream Commission at its meeting on September 22nd. The 15-day notice runs today. No lawsuit has yet been filed. So a summary of all of this would be The Interstate Stream Commission has a pending decision that is important for New Mexico. It can say yes and tell the Secretary of the Interior that it wishes to proceed with this infeasible project. If it does, the federal government will start a years-long process to evaluate the project's compliance with federal environmental law and to prepare an environmental impact statement. I can tell you that the environmental impact statement for the Buck Direct Diversion Project in Santa Fe, which I worked on continuously from start to finish representing the city of Santa Fe and Santa Fe County, took 5 years and cost $5 million. This will be more expensive. There's much more controversy. The other decision that the Interstate Stream Commission could make, but gives every indication of not making, is to say no to this infeasible project and to find a way to spend the money that Senator Domenici appropriated in Mexico, which has now grown to about $90 million, on needed meritorious projects that would do good in southwest New Mexico. For examples, infrastructure improvements could be made to every publicly owned drinking water system in the four-county area. Arsenic and uranium treatment facilities could be provided to the drinking water systems that are out of compliance. Water conservation, both for municipalities and for agricultural, could be funded. A fund could be set up to address drought conditions, maybe forever, not knowing how much money would initially be expended. The decision that the Interstate Stream Commission should make is extremely clear. It's a puzzle to me why they haven't had one moment, not one moment, of policy discussions in the last year to talk about their decision, the criteria by which they will make this decision, their choices, public comments, or anything else. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back after this short break. Stay with us as we continue listening to the Interim Water and Natural Resources Committee's recent meeting on the Arizona Water Settlements Act here on Earth Matters, Gila Members Community Radio, 89.1 FM. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. We've been bringing to you today the recording of the Interim Water and Natural Resources Committee meeting held on October 6th in Las Vegas. Four presentations on the Arizona Water Settlements Act were heard, and the next speaker up is Dr. Mark Stone of the University of New Mexico. He's one of the many researchers who participated in the Gila River Flow Needs Assessment.
Is that all the testimony? If that's all the testimony, then I'll go to questions from the committee members.
No, we have two more.
Okay, right.
Great, thank you. So let me just get this started. So I have a couple of slides to go through, but
Introduce yourself.
My name is Dr. Mark Stone. I'm with the University of New Mexico Department of Civil Engineering, where I'm a professor of water resources engineering. I'm also associate director for the water resources program there and associate chair for graduate studies of the civil engineering department. And what I'm going to discuss briefly this morning, a change of pace from the last couple of presentations, just to talk about some of the research that we've been doing out in Gila to understand how potential diversion projects might influence the stream itself and its riparian zone. And this is a very small component of a large study that was spearheaded by the Nature Conservancy, funded by the Bureau of Reclamation. And there was a large report, 400 and some pages, generated as part of this. I'm not sure if that's been circulated to this committee or not, but I'm sure it happily would be. But I'm just going to focus on a very small part of it, some work that my research team did at UNM, looking at the process of riparian recruitment. So I'm just going to run through a couple of slides here, and I'll try to keep this brief. But the first couple of slides have all been summarized on the first slide for your handout there, but that is just looking at a couple of different years here where we can investigate the stream flow patterns of the Gila River. And what I want you to notice and recognize as I go from 2004 and add on 2005 and then add on 2006 is the remarkable diversity of stream flow conditions that exists down in the Gila. This is all stream flow records from the U.S. Gila near Gila gauge. And as you compare these different years, and the same is true as you go from year to year to year, these different patterns start to emerge, but we have to keep in mind the remarkable diversity from year to year. So in 2004, for example, we had a rather weak snowpack. It came off in first in March and then a second wave in April, and almost no monsoon to speak of. In 2005 was the last really good snowpack that we had down in that area. We had a really big runoff season, happened early, and then again, almost no monsoon materialized whatsoever. And then in 2006, it was one of the most pathetic snowpacks on record, hardly any snow runoff to even recognize, and that was followed by a remarkable monsoon. So my research program focuses on understanding how these types of stream flow patterns or modifications from these types of stream flow patterns, whether it be from human interaction with the river, changes in the watershed, forest fire, etc., how these types of patterns influence the river processes themselves, such as riparian recruitment, which is what I'm going to focus on today. You can also take this information and look at it broader brush by breaking it down and taking things like median and mean flows. This was touched upon earlier by the speakers who preceded me. With this type of information, you can get an idea of the broad patterns in these flow characteristics, but it's really important to keep in mind, again, just jumping back one slide, how much variability exists within these stream flow records. So this is looking at the entire period of record, and we can see the median and mean flows. These two terms are really different in the Gila River because the mean gets highly skewed because of a few extreme events. So you have a couple of floods that happen spread throughout the entire flow record. All of a sudden, the mean flow jumps up. But the median flow is a very important term to keep in mind because that's the flow that happens 50% of the time. It's above that, and 50% of the time it's below that. So when you're thinking about longer-term trends, it's important to take these two pieces of information together. What we did was we broke this down into different seasons so we could investigate how the Gila behaves over long patterns, over long periods of time, and what this means for different processes such as riparian recruitment. So each year, depends on the year how strong this is, but we would expect a snowmelt runoff season, followed by a very consistent summer low flow. There's very low variability in this particular time of the year. We have low flows consistently in June and into July until the monsoon arrives, followed by the monsoon season, and then a fall, winter, and base flow, which persists throughout the fall and into the early winter until the snowpack starts to come off. So our research program is interested in understanding both these year-to-year variations and variations within the year, what that means for the ecology of the river, so that we can generate models that can predict how changes to these stream flow characteristics might influence the river. So, since I'm an engineer and I like models because they help us understand underlying processes and also to make predictions, and it can help us interpret what's happening inside the river channel. That's exactly what we did. We developed a series of models based on a lot of different input that could help us understand how these different stream flow characteristics, the hydrographs themselves, actually interact with the river and what those interactions mean for different processes of interest. And then ultimately, do we expect some type of change to happen if water is pulled out of the river? So this is just an example of one of our study sites. If you're familiar with the region, this is downstream from the Iron Bridge. The model results shown here are from a very high resolution two-dimensional hydrodynamic model. So what we're doing is we are solving the rules of physics to describe for any given stream flow exactly how that water will spread out onto the floodplain. And what's really interesting, but let me break down the scale here for you, the colors represent at what stream flow we would expect those different parts of the channel to actually receive water. So what's interesting about the Gila River, which makes it a very fascinating and dynamic system from a river engineering perspective, is that it has this very complex floodplain with a lot of side channels, what are sometimes referred to as secondary channels, where the water engages these different channels at relatively moderate flows. So as you can see, as you start going from 800 up to 3,000, 4,000 CFS, you really start to get a lot of river out into these little finger channels, which play very important ecological functions. So what we were interested in is, well, if we are to have some changes to the stream flow characteristics, what influence might that have on specifically the process of riparian regeneration? So first question we need to ask is, well, what does it require to have successful riparian regeneration? So this is a little cottonwood seedling, and this was our species that we really focused on, is cottonwoods and willows. And in order to get cottonwood recruitment for new seedlings to successfully regenerate and move forward as a successful cohort, we need to have some things that need to align. First of all, we need to have viable seeds available. The key there is that we need to have the right conditions at the right time of the year, allergy season, right in the spring when you start to have all the pollen come out into the air. That's when the cottonwoods are shedding their seeds. We need to have the right soil conditions. So just like any seed that you want to get established, you need to have access to a soil, and you want that soil to be moist. We need to have the right groundwater conditions. So as the stream flow recedes, if it recedes too quickly, the seedlings won't be able to keep up, and therefore they'll desiccate and they'll die. And as I've already alluded to, timing is really important when you consider these different factors. So I won't get into the nitty-gritty, but I'll give you the basic gist of how we developed our model. So this is an example of two different stream flow conditions. One is baseline, meaning this was from the observed data at the Gila gauge. The width diversion scenario was based on a spreadsheet model that was developed by Steve Bassett at the Nature Conservancy to represent the potential a potential diversion scenario under the terms of the Arizona Water Settlement Act. And this is how our model would apply to this particular situation. So this is, again, 2004, the same year that I started with at the beginning. So the first thing we need to consider is, what are the hydrologic conditions when we actually have viable seeds? And the viability of the seeds, again, changes over the year, but primarily we're interested in early April up through early June or so. After that, the viability really drastically declines as the seeds desiccate. We are then interested in, what is the stream flow? So if you are one of those side channels that happens to inundate when you have a flow between 500 and 600 CFS, then this particular flow event would have led to successful inundation of that surface, and then you would have a chance for recruitment. So in this little box, this is why it's referred to as the box recruitment model, is where we actually would have expected a chance for successful cottonwood recruitment. That is, the timing was right and the flows were right to support that type of recruitment. For this particular circumstance, under this particular model diversion, we wouldn't have expected a recruitment event to occur. So then the broader question is, well, is this an anomaly? Is this some random case that just happens to look this way? Or is this something we would expect on a wide basis, both in space and over a long period? So that's exactly what our model intended to capture. So I'm just going to jump into the results. We have recently gotten this work published in the highest rated water resources journal, Water Resources Research, from the American Geophysical Union. So if you're interested, I'm happy to provide reprints. If you need help falling to sleep late evening, this will do it for you. Get into some scientific literature. But I'll give you the highlights, skip to the color. And that is that we did predict that for certain areas of the channel that we would expect to see a reduction in riparian recruitment, cottonwoods and willows, as a result of the diversion scenarios that we investigated. I'm just highlighting here one of the particular scenarios, and this is just for one of the sites. This is, again, the Iron Bridge area. And the color code here represents what type of a change in recruitment we would expect. The white stripe down the middle of the channel here is the actual river. So we don't expect riparian recruitment in that area. That's the river, not the riparian zone. These other white islands out in the floodplain, like areas like this, we don't expect a change because those surfaces only inundate at very high flows. And the very high flows are not very sensitive to changes under this diversion strategy, especially because the diversions are limited to 350 CFS as a maximum. So 350 CFS off of 10,000 CFS, for example, doesn't result in a big change. Where we did predict a large change in repair and improvement was in those side channels that I pointed out. So if you see the bright red spots, this is where our model is telling us we would expect to see less repair and recruitment. And those are, again, in those side channels on sandbars and gravel bars where we currently see repair and recruitment. So that's basically what I wanted to share with you today, just some research that we've been doing to help understand how different diversion strategies might influence the ecology down there. And if anyone's interested in learning more about this work or the other work that we've been working on in riparian zones, we're more than happy to share references or be in touch with you directly. Thank you.
We'll be right back with Earth Matters after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. We're bringing to you today a recording of the recent Interim Water and Natural Resources Committee meeting held in Las Vegas, New Mexico. The committee discussed the Arizona Water Settlements Act, and the fourth speaker on the panel is Dr. David Probst, retired fish biologist with the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish. Let's listen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Probst. I'm retired from the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, where I was a native fish section leader for about 26 years. I'm now an adjunct professor at the University of New Mexico in the Department of Biology. The Gila River Basin in New Mexico supports an incredibly rich and diverse fauna. Over 300 bird species, more than 100 mammals, more than 70 reptiles and amphibians, and 12 fish species have been documented in this region. Many of these organisms are partially or completely restricted to habitats associated with the Gila River and its tributaries. An important area of the Gila River is a 20-mile-long Cliff Gila Valley. All of the native organisms that occur in the Cliff Gila Valley are adapted to a highly variable system, one in which river flows can increase from less than 100 CFS to several thousand in a matter of hours and then decline just as rapidly. Indeed, this variation is essential to sustaining the diverse fauna of the valley. Although adapted to natural variation, most native species do poorly in human-altered habitats. In addition, modified habitats are frequently colonized by non-native species that bring alien diseases, prey upon, compete with, or hybridize with native species. The Cliff Gila Valley Reach is receiving considerable attention as a possible location for a diversion structure under the terms of the Arizona Water Settlement Act. Mr. Gaughan and Dr. Stone have briefed you on many of the physical challenges facing such a structure presents, but I want to focus on the environmental issues, especially those involving state and federally protected species. The Cliff Gila Valley supports one of the most largest populations of southwest willow flycatcher. Provides winter and nesting habitat for yellow-billed cuckoo. Chiricahua leopard frog has been documented in the valley, but is no longer present or has been recently collected. There are also two snake species that have been proposed for federal listing that occur in the valley, as well as two fish species, spike dace and loach minnow, which are federally listed as endangered. For the remainder of this presentation, I really want to focus on spike dace. It, in many ways, is sort of the poster child of the problems that native fishes will be facing in the valley if the proposed or if a diversion structure is constructed at the head of the valley. The life cycle of spike dace is intimately linked to the river's flow regime. A critical period for spike dace is that it begins at the beginning of the recession of the spring runoff through about early August, late July, when the monsoon season begins. It's within this period of time that spike dace spawn, and their spawning occurs over clean gravel in relatively shallow water. And it's also during this period that spike dace attain the largest or greatest growth. So this period of recession is incredibly important for this organism. Another point to remember on this species is it is a very short-lived animal. Most individuals live less than a year. Very few survive to the second year to reproduce. So to maintain a viable population of the species,
You have to have annual response, successful annual spawning and recruitment. If this doesn't occur annually, the species is that much more imperiled. Now, if we go through just the basics of what their life history strategies are and the habitats they need, is that if you look at this upper graph here, you'll see that as they grow larger and transition from larvae to juveniles to adults, they move into faster velocity water. But you also note that this is a comparatively narrow range of water, is that by the adult stage, or the juvenile stage, they start occupying water that's flowing about a half a foot per second. And the max is about a foot and a half per second. So they're going to be searching for water that's got this distribution range of, or range of velocities. If we were going to plot depth on this graph, we would show you pretty much the same result. Most spike days occur in water that's 3 to 9 inches deep. Now, if we look at a typical hydrograph, and this is from 1995, the red line represents what the flow regime from February, or the discharge from February through the 1st of August was. I'm sorry, that's the yellow line. That's the natural flow regime. Now, if we go to what the flows would be under a CUFA diversion with 150 CFS minimum, that's represented by the red line. The green horizontal line at the top represents the spawning period, and the purple line represents the larval growth period. The larvae are basically from the time they hatch out at about 5 or 6 millimeters, which is not much more than a quarter of an inch, up to about 35 millimeters, which is maybe an inch and a quarter, inch and a half in length. This is a critical time for it. So under the CUFA diversion, you would rapidly drop the water in early spring, and when the water discharge declines that rapidly, there's a considerable amount of sediment deposition. And sediment deposition on the developing eggs will basically smother them, and so that increases mortality just by smothering eggs. And then with the sustained period of low flows, water temperatures increase. And as water temperatures get above a certain level, fish or the larvae start getting stressed, and you have additional mortality that's associated with that. And then the sustained period of low flows means that there's some loss of habitats for all species or all life stages of spike days within this area that's affected. And then finally, once you've reached the limit of withdrawals under the CUFA terms, water flows go back up immediately. Well, larvae are very small, and this rapid increase in flows ends up displacing large numbers of them downstream, increasing mortality either as a result of physical stress associated with displacement or predation by non-native species such as channel catfish and smallmouth bass. One other thing about spike days, one reason it is endangered is, well, obviously it's rare, and I've listed because it's rare, and threats to its existence. Within New Mexico, there are two populations, one in the Cliff Hill Valley, the other in the Forks area, the Gila River, which is upstream about 35 to 40 miles. The third population for this species is in Aripaipa Creek in Arizona. So globally, this species has three populations, one in Arizona and two in New Mexico. Under this situation, we know this from genetic studies, there's movement of individuals from the upstream population to the downstream population, and then vice versa, from the downstream to the upstream. This movement is important demographically to help maintain populations so that if there are events that diminish numbers in one area, they can be supplemented by individuals from the other area. Another critically important aspect of this is that it allows, we know that there's genetic exchange, and as long as there's movement of individuals, we maintain the genetic diversity that's necessary to keep the species viable as a whole. If we are to construct a diversion dam at the top of the valley, that's going to effectively block movement upstream from the Cliff Hill Valley to the upstream population, and will likely diminish, if not eliminate, movement from the upstream population to the lower population. If we have some natural catastrophe, such as wildfire, which we did have this past 2 years ago with the whitewater balding, we can have serious impacts on that upstream population, potentially eliminating it. With a diversion structure in place, there's no possibility of individuals from the lower population moving upstream to the upper population recolonizing that area. So by this event, we've lost one population, and now the species is down to two populations globally. And with the loss of the exchange between populations, the genetic viability of the lower population is diminished, and overall and over time, the numbers will reduce, thereby making them that much more vulnerable to extinction. In addition to the changes that physical changes to the environment, how this might negatively affect the fish, these changes are also going to increase the likelihood of non-native or invasive species becoming more of a problem. Currently in the system, there are a number of non-natives, but they are not common within the Clifton Valley. With change in flow regime, it might provide additional opportunities for some of these noxious non-native species to increase in abundance to the detriment of spycase and other listed species. More importantly, perhaps, is the proposed the idea that we have off-stream storage facilities. These off-stream storage facilities will become havens for problem non-native species, particularly species such as American bullfrog, which is not native to the area, northern crayfish, that's illustrated on this slide, and sunfish such as green sunfish. All of these organisms prey upon native fishes and other native organisms, and so by increasing the preferred habitat of these non-natives, we increase the extinction risk for species such as spycase. So what I've gone through very rapidly using spycase as an example of some of the problems that native species, particularly the fish, and spycase in particular, will face if there's a diversion structure placed on the river. And the federal agencies will be having to review what all of the potential impacts of such an action are. And what I'm going to go through very rapidly right now are a list of things or issues that are going to have to be considered in any evaluation of a project. Now, this is not necessarily an exhaustive or a complete list, but it is a list of some of those questions that they will have to be asking and answering to determine what the extinction risk is to a species such as spycase or lochmen. Those, both of them are illustrated here. The first question is, how will the flow regime be affected by a diversion? And will this disrupt the connectivity between the floodplain and the river? That connectivity is critical for aquatic species in that a lot of the nutrients that fuel the aquatic system come from terrestrial habitats. So if that connectivity is disrupted, there will be less productivity in the river, having negative consequences for aquatic organisms. The next question is water withdrawal, and that's going to be done with a diversion structure, and how it's done and when it's done, what effect is this going to have on disrupting life history stages of native fishes? Is it going to sweep by jacking the water back up or returning to the natural flows? Is that going to displace larvae downstream? Another question is this going to result in habitat alterations? And how might that affect negatively species of fish and other organisms in the valley? Then with the diversion structure itself, how much influence is this going to have on range fragmentation? Range fragmentation or smaller habitats for many imperiled species is one of the critical problems that they have. If you do not have, the organisms do not have the ability to move from one area to the other, you increase the likelihood that there will be local extinctions. This isolation means that there's likely to be increased genetic inbreeding, and that will lead to the detriment of species and, again, reducing their viability. Another thing which we just mentioned is the question of invasive species. How many more invasive species to come in, and with the ones that are currently there, do we provide the conditions that enable their numbers and abundance to increase to the detriment of native organisms? All of this means that there are going to be smaller populations, which means there's going to be increased extinction risk. Under the Endangered Species Act, federal agencies are going to have to be considering the impacts of any modification of the system and how this is going to affect the fish. For an organism such as a spycase that currently only has three populations globally, there basically is no room for error. Anything that's done is going to be very carefully scrutinized to ensure that it does not further or further enhance or increase its risk of extinction. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, That's the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our program today. We're pleased to have brought you an audio recording of the October 6th meeting of the Interim Water and Natural Resources Committee and the panel on the Arizona Water Settlements Act with ISC Deputy Director Craig Repke, former ISC Director Norm Gaum, UNM Professor Dr. Mark Stone, and retired New Mexico Department of Game and Fish Biologist Dr. Dave Probst. If you'd like to listen to the questions and answers from legislators that follow the panel, we've made those available via podcast on the Gila Members Community Radio website at gmcr.org/category/earth-matters. This is a very interesting discussion that covered transparency and open government issues, Gila River diversion project costs, financing, and a lot more. That's it for this week's edition of Earth Matters. Thanks to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson, and thank you for tuning in to this week's program. I'm Allison Civic, and I hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio 89.1 FM.